encouraging it indicates his judgment has been compromised. The special counsel regulations require that a person outside the Department of Justice, which includes the FBI, be chosen. The reason is quite simple: to avoid conflicts of interest with individuals who work for those departments so that the investigation can be fair and objective. However, in selecting Mueller, Rosenstein picked the ultimate insider. Mueller spent years as a top official at the Justice Department and also served as director of the FBI. He knew just about everyone and was particularly close to Comey and Rosenstein. While it is true that Mueller was no longer employed at DOJ when he was named special counsel, his various conflicts of interest demonstrate that he was exactly the kind of person the regulations sought to avoid. Many other qualified lawyers would have been better suited for the job and could have brought a greater sense of impartiality and legitimacy to the process. The unfortunate decision was made, of course, by Rosenstein, who was beset by his conflicts of interest. Rosenstein should have recused himself. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein has a conflict of interest so acute that no sincere debate could be waged on whether he should have stepped aside. No credible argument can be made in his favor. His refusal to recuse himself in the face of ethical rules that demand his disqualification underscores just how tainted and corrupt the special counsel investigation has become. It is well established that Mueller is examining whether Trump's firing of Comey was a corrupt act intended to obstruct any investigation into Trump-Russian collusion. The president has insisted that he relied in whole or in part on Rosenstein's recommendation that Comey be terminated for the reasons detailed in the deputy AG's memorandum of May 9, 2017. As Mueller seeks to determine Trump's intent, Rosenstein is a central witness. He had conversations with the president and Attorney General Jeff Sessions about discharging Comey on May 8, 2017, and perhaps on other occasions. Under the regulations, Title 28 of the CFR, Section 600.7, Rosenstein is in charge of the special counsel's investigation and is Mueller's direct supervisor. As acting attorney general on the case, Rosenstein oversees it, authorizing the scope of the special counsel's probe. He also wields the ultimate power to decide whether a prosecution will be brought, as stated in the regulations. The Attorney General may request that the special counsel provide an explanation for any investigative or prosecutorial step, and may, after review, conclude that the action is so inappropriate or unwarranted under established departmental practices that it should not be pursued. The Wall Street Journal has reported that Mueller's office interviewed Rosenstein in June or July 2017. Think about what that represents. Mueller answers to Rosenstein, but the special counsel and or his deputies interviewed their boss as a witness. That boss, in turn, plays an instrumental role in deciding whether any case will be leveled against the president based, in whole or in part, on his own testimony. In an appearance before members of the House of Representatives in May 2017, Rosenstein was questioned as to who had asked him, if anyone had asked him, to write his memorandum. His answer was quite simple. That is Bob Mueller's purview. By refusing to disclose who requested that he compose the memo, Rosenstein was admitting that the very investigation he was supervising would involve himself as a witness. It is fundamentally wrong and unethical for Rosenstein to supervise a case in which he is a chief witness and to simultaneously judge whether a prosecution should be brought. This is the equivalent of a prosecutor putting his boss or himself on the witness stand to testify in the very case he is prosecuting. A lawyer cannot be an investigator, witness, prosecutor, and judge all rolled into one. Rosenstein plays each of these roles in a single case. His failure to disqualify himself is a serious lapse in judgment. Such conduct is strictly forbidden by the rules of professional conduct. Understandably, Trump complained about Rosenstein's conflict of interest in a tweet. "I am being investigated for firing the FBI director by the man who told me to fire the FBI director. Witch hunt." His point was a valid one. In one short sentence, he enunciated the flagrant conflict that prompted Professor Turley to conclude, "If Mueller is investigating Trump for obstruction, Rosenstein should immediately recuse himself." His failure to do so, wrote Turley, is a glaring ethical omission. The same regulations that required Mueller to step down apply to Rosenstein as well. yet both men refused to do so. This renders the entire special counsel's investigation inherently suspect amid persistent questions of self-interest, political bias, and a lack of objectivity. Jack Goldsmith, professor of law at Harvard University and a former assistant attorney general, observed that Rosenstein is a fact witness in any obstruction inquiry because he possesses information about the president's beliefs and motives in firing Comey. He added, "I cannot fathom how, in this light, he remains the supervisor in charge of that investigation, since a reasonable person would question his impartiality." Rosenstein has been mum on the subject of recusal, except to say that he would do so if needed. The public is supposed to trust him, even in the face of the appearance of impropriety due to his conflict as a witness. Rosenstein is a vital witness in the case, as evidenced by the report that he was interviewed by the special counsel about Trump's stated motives in firing Comey. As noted in the last chapter, the acting attorney general told investigators that the president knew the firing of the FBI director would not end the Trump-Russia probe, which would discredit any claim that Trump tried to obstruct the case. Rosenstein cannot claim he is merely a peripheral witness who need not be recused. This represents all the more reason why he should have disqualified himself from the case. Beyond his conflict of interest, Rosenstein had no legal basis to appoint a special counsel to begin with, since there was no discernible crime. Joseph DeGeneva, a former independent counsel and former U.S. attorney, was unsparing in his condemnation of Rosenstein's actions. His conduct from the beginning has been a disgrace. Rod Rosenstein has single-handedly taken away from the sitting president of the United States 16 months, and counting, of his presidency by his incompetent and fearful conduct. Rosenstein appointed Mueller because he didn't want to make the tough decisions that you'd have to make if you were supervising a case being run by a U.S. attorney. But in addition to appointing a special counsel without a legal basis, Rosenstein also approved the team of partisans put together by Mueller to assist him. Mueller assembled a team of partisans. Mueller sabotaged his own investigation. He has only himself to blame for ruining what could have been viewed as a credible probe. He deliberately assembled a team of partisans with a history of political bias who appeared determined to undo the results of the 2016 presidential election and drive President Trump from office. Mueller did more than choose to stack the deck of his special counsel staff with biased crusaders. He hired many people with direct personal connections to Hillary Clinton, transforming what was supposed to be an impartial investigation into an illegitimate and seemingly corrupt one. Rosenstein, who had direct oversight and supervision, condoned the staff selection. He could have objected and demanded that Mueller hire a more balanced team of lawyers and investigators who might have brought a measure of neutrality and objectivity to the investigation. He did not do this. The media has always been quick to point out that Mueller is a Republican. However, this may or may not be true now. While Mueller was known to be a member of the GOP when he was appointed as FBI director in 2001, his current party registration is not clear. He has served in government positions under appointment by leaders of both parties. President Bill Clinton nominated Mueller to be U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of California in 1998. In 2011, President Barack Obama asked Mueller to stay on as director of the FBI. His political predilections are something he rarely discloses, but his actions as special counsel showed clear partisanship. Among the 16 publicly confirmed lawyers hired by Mueller, not a single one of them is registered as a Republican, according to an in-depth analysis of records by the Daily Caller. A similar investigation by Fox News confirmed the same findings. 13 of the attorneys are registered Democrats, while 3 have no party affiliation. The majority of them have donated to Democrats, including several who gave money to the Obama-Clinton presidential campaigns. Only one lawyer, James Quarles, made donations to Republicans, but the two contributions he made pale in comparison to the nearly $38,000 he gave to Democrats. Even more disturbing than the political imbalance on Mueller's staff are the instances of bias that many on the team harbor. The bias of Peter Sturzok and Lisa Page has been well documented herein. They were removed from the team as a consequence. After them, the most notorious is Andrew Weissman. After acting Attorney General Sally Yates, an Obama holdover, defied a direct order from President Trump to defend his newly issued travel ban, Weissman sent her a message. I am so proud and in awe. Thank you so much. All my deepest respects. This fawning email to Yates spoke volumes about Weissman's contempt for Trump and his lack of partiality in his role investigating the president. But that's not all. When Clinton threw what she thought would be an election night victory party at the Javits Center in New York City, Weissman attended the bash that quickly turned sour when Trump won. Weissman is a prosecutor who is known for what has been described as abusive tactics, using the law as a weapon in a sometimes unprincipled quest to convict. He has been accused of suppressing evidence and threatening witnesses. Innocent people have been victimized by his maneuvers. Some of his biggest cases were reversed by higher courts. As a federal prosecutor, Weissman helped drive the accounting firm Arthur Andersen out of business, costing tens of thousands of people their jobs, only to have the convictions reversed unanimously by the U.S. Supreme Court. The legal smackdown by the High Court underscores what a wrongful prosecution he pursued. But Weissman was undeterred. He went after Merrill Lynch executives, putting them behind bars and destroying their lives, only to have that case also reversed, this time by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. All of this should have been enough for Weissman to be banished from the Department of Justice. But Mueller came to the rescue by hiring him as general counsel at the FBI. Weissman eventually made his way back to the Justice Department as head of the Criminal Fraud Division in the Obama administration. When Mueller became special counsel in the Trump-Russia investigation, he immediately turned to his old pit bull of a prosecutor, Weissman, who joined the team. As former federal prosecutor Powell observed, "We all lose from Weissman's involvement. First, the truth plays no role in Weissman's quest. Second, respect for the rule of law, simple decency, and following the facts do not appear in Weissman's playbook. Third, and most important, all Americans lose whenever our judicial system becomes a weapon to reward political friends and punish political foes." Mueller knew full well what he was doing when he brought Weissman on board his team of partisans. Weissman was the partisan in chief. The special counsel also brought to his staff Jeannie Rhee, who was a partner with Mueller at the law firm of Wilmer Hale. The hiring of Rhee was especially brazen since she defended the Clinton Foundation in a civil racketeering case and donated $5,400 to Clinton's presidential campaign. Thus, Rhee is in a position to bring a prosecution against the person who defeated the candidate she supported and defended. It was a shamelessly bold hire by Mueller, given how obvious a conflict of interest Rhee has. She also worked for Andrew McCabe, who was fired by the FBI for lack of candor. She represented ex-Obama aide Ben Rhodes during the congressional investigation into the Benghazi attack, an inquiry that focused primarily on Clinton's role. The Clinton connections extended to others on Mueller's team of partisans. Aaron Zebley is on the special counsel team of lawyers, having previously served as Mueller's chief of staff at the FBI. He represented Justin Cooper, who worked for Clinton and set up her private email server, registering the domain in his own name. He also admitted destroying Clinton's BlackBerry devices, breaking them in half or hitting them with a hammer. He did not have security clearance for any of the classified documents on Clinton's server, yet had access to it. Zebley's involvement in the Clinton case creates yet another appearance of impropriety in the Mueller probe. Another of Mueller's lawyers is Kyle Freeney, who worked at the Justice Department. She was one of the prosecutors that U.S. District Court Judge Andrew Hannon excoriated in a 2014 case for serious misconduct in her defense of President Obama's executive actions on immigration. In a blistering critique, Freeney and other lawyers were accused of misleading the court in what the judge described as intentional, serious, and material misconduct. After an apology from the DOJ, Judge Hannon said he would accept the department's claims that the representations to the court were unintentional. Campaign finance records show Freeney donated money to both the Obama and Clinton campaigns. Just about every member of Mueller's carefully chosen team has ties or allegiances to Democrats, Obama, or the Clintons. In an appearance before the House Judiciary Committee in December 2017, Rosenstein tried in vain to deflect repeated criticism that the special counsel's investigation was tainted by insider bias. When confronted with the evidence that Mueller had hired no Republicans but nearly all Democrats, many of whom donated money to Trump's opponent, Rosenstein insisted that it did not create even the appearance of impropriety which Justice Department regulations prohibit. It was an absurd defense of Mueller's decision to pack his staff with political partisans. Cheating in a game of cards can involve stacking the deck, arranging the cards in a way that advantages yourself while ensuring your opponent loses. It is almost certain that this is the way Special Counsel Robert Mueller approached his investigation. He chose to hire for his staff a group of lawyers who are Democrats and others like Sturzok and Page who vented in their messages their hostility toward Trump. Factor into the equation Mueller and Rosenstein's own disqualifying conflicts of interest, and you have an investigation that bears no resemblance to fairness. The genuine fear is that this special counsel team is so rife with bias that it is more interested in convictions and the political damage that can be wrought on the president than in seeing that justice is done.
Epilogue. Subverting the rule of law. A Government of Laws and Not of Men. John Adams, Novanglis Papers, No. 7, 1774. I am not a Trump apologist or sycophant. He will be the first to tell you that. In the handful of conversations and meetings I had with the president over the past year, he gently reminded me of my earlier reporting that he regarded as negative or critical of him. He had a right to do so, and it was fair. Why then would I write a book that is, in large part, a defense of Trump? In truth, this book is a defense of the rule of law. Came under sustained attack by high government officials who abused their positions of power to subvert our system of justice and undermine the democratic process. Trump was their target and their victim. As facts emerged, I became incensed that top figures of the FBI and Department of Justice misconstrued the law in a manner that could only have been deliberate. They absolved Hillary Clinton of the felony statute she so flagrantly violated. They weaponized other laws and regulations to investigate Trump without legal justification in an effort to destroy him. These officials breached their duty to uphold the law. They compromised essential principles and damaged the nation's trust. Their unconscionable actions inflicted significant harm to the reputation of federal law enforcement and the integrity of the thousands of individuals who serve faithfully and honorably. The law is inviolate. If it is to function properly as the foundation of democracy, it must be fairly and equitably administered without favor, regardless of politics and circumstances. This did not happen. When the legal system is corrupted, all Americans suffer. We lose confidence in our government of laws. As Adams warned, it becomes a government of men who empower themselves to transgress the very rights and liberties we cherish. In this endeavor, the press plays a vital role. It is an indispensable check on excessive government authority. This is what the framers envisioned when they embraced the First Amendment in our Bill of Rights. Sadly, it did not always occur in the reporting of this story by the mainstream media. All too often, journalists were complicit in advancing or excusing the abuse of power. They convicted Trump in the court of public opinion without evidence cognizable in law. This is another reason why I decided to write this book. Fueled by the FBI's unwarranted investigation, reporters became advocates. They condemned Trump for the least infraction and inflated any encounter with persons connected, however tangentially, to Russia. Many in the media, motivated by their own bias, drove the constant narrative that Trump and those in his orbit colluded with Moscow to steal the 2016 presidential election from Clinton. When the new president fired FBI Director James Comey, the action was immediately interpreted and portrayed by the press as irrefutable proof of obstruction of justice. Some journalists accused Trump of being Putin's puppet or a de facto agent of the Kremlin. Articles were published implying that Trump was a Manchurian candidate. The unfairness of the media was palpable. Rank speculation was treated as fact. Stories were agenda-driven, not information-driven. Indictment and impeachment were persistent themes in both print and television news. At every turn, the media demonized the president by declaring him guilty of the conjured crime of collusion. It became their favorite truncheon. Examples of this abound. When Trump's lawyer Jay Sekulow was interviewed on ABC News by anchor George Stephanopoulos, the following exchange took place about a Trump advisor who spoke to a person with Russian contacts. Sekulow: "There is no crime of collusion. What is a violation of law here?" Stephanopoulos: "Collusion is cooperation." Viewers were left with the impression that the act of talking with someone constituted collusion, which equaled the commission of a crime. Yet there was no evidence of a secret agreement to achieve some fraudulent or illegal or deceitful purpose. It was all too easy for the anchor to insinuate a crime by using a word that connotes a crime. The appearance of criminality seemed sufficient for many reporters. Others took to the airwaves to imply or pronounce criminal collusion without ever identifying what law might have been broken or the specific facts that merited such a legal conclusion. Carl Bernstein on CNN: "I think this is a potentially more dangerous situation than Watergate. We're at a dangerous moment, and that's because we're looking at the possibility that the President of the United States and those around him during an election campaign colluded with a hostile foreign power to undermine the basis of our democracy-free elections." Dan Rather on MSNBC: "Donald Trump is afraid. He's trying to exude power and strength. He's afraid of something that Mueller and the prosecutors are going to find out. A political hurricane is out there at sea for him. We'll call it Hurricane Vladimir, if you will, the whole Russian thing. It is approaching Category 4. Jake Tapper, CNN anchor: "This is evidence of willingness to commit collusion. That's what this is on its face." Lawrence O'Donnell, MSNBC host: "Donald Trump now sits at the threshold of impeachment." These were by no means the only instances in which the media proclaimed Trump and his associates culpable of criminal collusion. One anchor averred with certainty, "They're confessing to colluding with the Russians." Another speculated that people might go to jail for the rest of their lives. Still another insisted, "They're acting super guilty because they're guilty." But guilty of what specifically? That vexing tidbit of information was conveniently omitted. Throughout the Trump presidency, the media obsessed over collusion without defining it. They assumed it was a crime that surely must exist, buried somewhere in the vast body of dusty law books. One anchor became so giddy over the prospect of Trump's arrest, she fantasized on air about the day he would barricade himself inside the White House as federal marshals banged on the door to take him into custody. The president's imminent demise became daily fodder. There has been no shortage of media malpractice in the age of Trump. Motivated by political bias and personal animus, some journalists were relentless in their quest to prove the president's illegitimacy and drive him from office. They abandoned objectivity and suspended their sense of fairness. They allowed enmity to cloud their judgment. In the process, the media squandered credibility, its only currency. It is no wonder that many Americans have little trust in journalists to be honest in their reporting. The people who should listen to this audiobook probably won't. Democrats, the liberal media, and the legion of Trump haters have convinced themselves that his election was misbegotten. but they are intellectually dishonest in believing that the president must have committed some crime in connection with Russia. Most have never bothered to examine the facts or consult a statute. Their confidence in collusion is bereft of proof. They accept it as a matter of faith driven by their own bias and teased by hope out of ignorance. I have no illusion that what I have written in these pages will persuade them otherwise. The anti-Trump crowd is so adamant in their disdain that no amount of reason will reach them. Yet they are equally blind to the astonishing level of corruption by those in government who sought to sabotage the president with false claims and drive him from office. Individuals who were sworn to uphold the law manipulated it for their own partisan purpose. Their self-righteous compulsion to correct what they perceive to be wrong in the election of Trump serves as the quintessential example of the arrogance of power. It has been both challenging and frustrating to compose a book as events were still unfolding. It was akin to the struggle of keeping pace with a fast-moving train. There will be more revelations to come as the Justice Department examines the venal conduct of those who cleared Clinton and targeted Trump. It may take months, if not years, before a true accounting is divulged. This is how cover-ups work. The truth is slow to emerge. Until then, the story told here presents more than sufficient facts for the listener to reach the inexorable conclusion that Trump was a victim, not the villain. There was never any plausible evidence that Trump or his campaign collaborated with Russia to win the presidency. The FBI had no legal basis to initiate its investigation. Facts were invented or exaggerated. Laws were perverted or ignored. The law enforcers became lawbreakers. Comey's scheme to trigger the appointment of his friend as special counsel was a devious maneuver by an unscrupulous man. His insinuation that the president obstructed justice was another canard designed to inflame the liberal media. Sure enough, they became witting accessories. When powerful forces in government abuse their positions of trust to subvert the legal process, and when the media acts in concert to condone or conceal corrupt behavior, democracy is threatened. Reverence to the rule of law is lost. This is the story of the Russia hoax. Greg Jarrett, April 28, 2018.
This is Charles Constant. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Russia Hoax, The Illicit Scheme to Clear Hillary Clinton and Frame Donald Trump, by Greg Jarrett. Presented by Broadside Books and Harper Audio. This program was produced by B Audio Limited. Executive producer, Jennifer Lopes. Text copyright 2018 by Greg Jarrett. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.